My name's Rachel Withers. It's May 2003 and I'm speaking to the artist Paul McCarthy. We're presently speaking in a room at the Groucho Club in Soho, London, and there's a certain amount of background noise coming from the ventilation system. Nevertheless, I'm delighted to be able to interview Paul McCarthy for Audio Arts Magazine. Paul, can I ask you first, you've recently completed installing a very major new work, Blockhead, which is an outdoor piece located on the banks of the Thames, immediately outside Tate Modern. Paul, I understand that this piece derives from a very large-scale piece that you made previously in Hanover.
Yeah. The piece, it came from... I had been interested in making inflatables. It's a large inflatable, and I'd sort of been toying around with the idea of making inflatables probably during the early 90s. I sort of started thinking about them. I'd made inflatables in the 60s, but they were mostly related to like kind of alternative architecture and stuff. But I was asked to... So this idea of inflatables had been sort of going along, and then I was asked to make a piece for the Hanover World's Fair. And there was a project called In Between, which was Kasper Koenig had invited a number of artists, and the World's Fair was in Hanover. They were expecting like 60 million people, and there was this. The title of this thing, In Between, was something about art and architecture. And I went to visit the grounds. The buildings were huge. The space was gigantic. And the Hanover World's Fair had asked a number of architects. And with really large budgets in the, closer to in the millions. And so then there was these six or seven artists asked, and at the same time there were budgets that were fairly large for, for these kinds of projects for artists, but like 300,000 and stuff like that, so which is, compared to any budget I'd ever had before, that seemed like a pretty big budget. And but you were sort of faced, compared to what the architects or what the fairgrounds were, you were sort of faced with this thing of what would the work be in relationship to these huge budgets and gigantic volumes of space, and here's these 8 or 9 artists with what appeared to be, relative to the art world, large budgets, but relative to the situation, nothing. You could barely dent it. And at first I was really interested in, and I had been really interested in this idea of producing a chocolate factory or a factory that produced candy. And because I'd been interested in chocolate and food, and I was actually trying to do a piece in a gallery where a chocolate bar or a chocolate figurine, 3,000 of them would be produced every day. And then by the end of the 30-day show, you'd end up with thousands of chocolate figurines. So when I was asked to be in the show, my immediate response was, and rather than going to physical scale, I was thinking more in terms of human scale. And when they said 60 million, I thought, well, 60 million people pass through this thing. It's like the size, it's like the population of England. As it turned out, they were really wrong in the projection, and it was more like 30 million. But still, a lot of people. So I thought, well, I'll make a factory at the fairgrounds and produce a candy bar. And if the candy bar can distribute or sell 2 million, that would be pretty interesting, I thought. Like, somehow I produced 2 million objects in this period of time, or maybe even more. Who knew what the candy bar could, more would happen. So in the process, I start working on it, and the figurine, first it was just designing of the figurine, and then, but they were really pushing me to somehow think in terms of architecture, and given that that was the title of they were using, or the subject they were using, and I sort of began to work on a building that the factory would exist in. So there was you know, I was trying to combine the two and think about it, but it was also money, like how big a space could I make for $300,000 and produce a chocolate factory. It wasn't enough money. And then everything broke loose, and the World's Fair wanted to dissolve the factory because it got into infringements on other people's, other people who had bought the rights to all the food in the fair. And then it got into health laws, and then, you know, somehow if I'm going to make a factory, then it has to come up to these health standards. And the piece got more and more complicated. As the factory got more and more complicated, I began thinking more and more about the building. And then decided, well, I probably can't do both. Can't do the factory and can't do the building. So I began to become more and more interested in the building. And the building went through a series of manifestations throughout, like a year or something like that. And eventually it sort of resolved itself to this large a Pinocchio figure sitting on a stack of books with a big cube on its head, and like an 85-foot inflatable. And then, of course, I wanted people to go in it. I wanted to maintain this fact that you would enter inside the space. And that created a real engineering nightmare. It's much easier to make an inflatable without a room in it. It's much easier to make an inflatable that just basically has cylinders or round shapes than it is to make one with square shapes. So as soon as the piece became to involve square objects or flat surfaces and you entered it, it then turned into be a lot about making a... it began to involve engineers and real technical problems, and the piece in one way got interesting that way because it involved other people, and it was in some ways it was building a building, a particular kind of building, you know. And I liked this idea of this architecture but this figure, so it was somewhere between a figure and an architecture. And
the piece on Tate, outside Tate Modern, seems rather like a pylon to me. It's the actual interior space is like the space underneath the legs of the pylon, and it seems you can actually look up into the interior, and it kind of tapers upwards. Am I approximately right there?
Well, it, you enter it and you can see up through it, and to a degree, it's like a tower. It's an I-beam construction. The I-beams are 10, 12 inches wide, and it rises up 85 feet and goes. It's narrower at one point. For the first 20 plus feet, or 7 meters or something, it's like a big box, and then it tapers in and then rises up again, and then that pole section, that column is like probably 3 meters square and rises like 20 meters. And so it has a tower, but it's a peculiar tower because it goes straight and then bends out. And but the tower is there to hold up the inflatable. And the inflatable is in three parts: the books, the body, and the head. And the head is a cube. And so it's put on that way. You put the books down, and you put the body on, and you put the head on. And they sort of attach. And they also have a whole other system of how they inflate. And the books inflate as walls. The body is one big air sac. And in the head is walls. And to a degree, I was interested in this idea of, from the inside, It's somewhat reminiscent of standing in the Eiffel Tower or underneath a tower like that and looking up, and or it has some associations to, I guess, like the Statue of Liberty or something like that. Somehow you're in one of these types of figure monuments, and you look up to a kind of structure up in. The thing about the piece is, and it's a kind of machine, the one in Hanover, the fans were on the outside. The one at the Tate, the fans are on the inside. I moved them to the inside. And when you're in it, you hear it. It's loud. It's almost, you can hear these fans, three of them, you're hearing three of them in that room. There's six fans altogether, I think. And maybe more, seven now, I'm not sure. I mean, we stuck up on the head. But so the inside of this thing is fans and air tunnels, you know, out of the fans into bodies or into books or whatever. So you're really aware of the sound when you're in it. You're aware of the superstructure, the I-beam structure. You're aware of how the books are constructed. You see these baffles. And then you look up and you see the I-beams, you see the wiring. So you're kind of, it's a little like being in the inside of a structure that might be like an oil rig or a boat or a ship or down in the basement of a building or a furnace room or something like that. It's not a refined space as if you're in the lobby of the building. It's more like you're in the basement of the building. And then I think there's this whole thing of looking up through, and you're basically looking up through the asshole of the figure, you know. So, or you're looking into the body of the figure through the bottom, through the ass, you know, where he sits. So you kind of get, you know, you're not, I don't know whether you're so aware that that's what's occurring or whether you're very aware that you're in a sort of, I think when you stand in it, you're very aware that you're in an architectural space and you don't think books. You're not reading books when you're standing inside. You're in a room with walls and I-beams and stuff, and then you look up and then you look into another space. And then the front has a sliding door. You look out of the door and you see St. Paul's across the river, which is sort of framed in the doorway. And you're looking between the feet. So you look through the door, you look through the feet. The feet becomes almost like, I think it might be compared to an alley, but I think at that point the feet become the rounded bulbous feet. So I think you're more aware of them as almost landscape. And then if you step out, or when you enter, when you first come on the piece and you look up, you're looking up at I kind of think has the sensation of a cliff. That's how I saw it. Like it's abstracted. You're not sure what you're looking at. I think, you know, you've approached it, so maybe you've figured out what it is: figure, books, cube head, feet. But when you stand below it and look up, it's like sort of undulating shapes with a big cube. But it hangs out over you. So for me, there was a sensation of cliff. And when it rains, the water comes off of it like a cliff right down into between the feet or down onto the feet. So it has a real sense of nature. You know? It also undulates in the wind. The whole piece moves as the wind blows a little bit, the arms and legs. So it kind of has there is a kind of kinetic to it. It kind of has a sense of animation or animated figure.
It has a slightly saggy look, I was thinking. Yeah. It sags a bit, and I found myself inevitably referring that back to other motifs in your work, and thinking about its structural relationship to work that you've done in the past. And I found myself formulating a sort of general question about the hollow nature of this object. And in particular in your work, the persistent way that the body features as a kind of a sack or a container. I was thinking there are many different potential ways of figuring the body, of thinking about the structure or the nature of the body. And I guess another one would be another one which features in your work, which is the idea of the body in pieces, as some sort of aggregate of component parts. But to return to this idea of hollowness, I was wondering, can I push you a little bit on that and ask why in particular is this idea of the hollow body, why has this been so preoccupied you to such an extent in your work as a metaphor?
I'm interested, and there are things to talk about in terms of relationship to the hollow body, in terms of human or animal or whatever. But it goes back to a point in minimalism where. My relationship to minimalism, and that was making an association or thinking about, and they kind of come together, the two ideas come together. One is thinking about Donald Judd or Tony Smith at that period of time in the 60s. I was a young artist, and minimalism was part of... it was part of a huge dialogue across the Western art world and all that. And I had sort of at one point in this idea of an essence of the form or the shape of whatever, the rectangle, the cube, whatever was being made. And in particular to those two artists, Judd too, although in Judd is slightly different, but I'd sort of came upon this thing of thinking about that the Tony Smith and the Judds were hollow. So if there was a discussion, it was sort of a discussion that wanted to focus on the shape or the form and dismiss the fact that it was hollow, or to even dismiss the fact of the material itself, what it was made from, whether it was metal or wood or plywood or something like that. And so there was this thing of sort of making work about what I thought wasn't being talked about, that it wasn't being discussed as a hollow, that the Tony Smith was hollow, and that was not being, it was not part of the dialogue. Although it did come up later, I think, in some essays on Judd and stuff like that, or on somebody more, so I remember later reading something. But at that point, when I was making art, all of a sudden I'm thinking, well, you know, we're looking at the thing, and everybody's having a discussion about the fact that it's this rectangular or this cube thing, and I'm thinking, well, it's hollow, you know? And so there was that, this thing, this sort of participating in a dialogue on minimalism or a critique on minimalism and me thinking about it being hollow.
I guess I was wondering whether you thought that there was something in particular about contemporary culture or the culture of the second half of the 20th century that makes that metaphor of the being, the human subject as a kind of a space or a kind of sack receptacle that needs to be filled, that is lacking a centre or lacking a, you know, has a void at its centre. Is there something about the organisation of contemporary Western culture that makes that a particularly kind of pressing metaphor? Or am I reading in too much?
I think as an artist, I follow some path of why I'm making something, and at the time, and even now, I think it was this subconsciously you make things, or you, I don't know whether or it may be in my own, for myself, I was how the culture or how my sense of reality based on whatever the culture's done, who I am or how I think has some relationship to what the culture is as conditioned or somehow how I think is related to the culture I'm in. So this idea of wanting to make work about this dilemma of of existence, and then equating or trying to make an object that talks about that through art, architecture, and my body. And it's something to do with cityscapes and these things also coming to some sort of thing where these configurations of vents and hallways and spaces being closed and with no way out.
I'm here with Victor Bergen in his studio at Goldsmiths. Victor, I'd like to talk to you about two exhibitions you've currently got on, one at Matt's Gallery and also one at the Arnolfini, which is a retrospective. And I'd like to begin by talking about the Arnolfini exhibition, which spans, in a sense, quite a lot of your career, although it's not a definitive retrospective. Could we begin by talking about the work which gave the exhibition its title, Listen to Britain? It's an installation work, and I'd like to talk about the marriage of the text, music, sound and image.
Well, the work's put together on the computer, and what attracted me to the computer back in 1986, when I had an arts residency at the List Centre at MIT, I discovered the computer there, not for its advanced capabilities, but for its then developing the capacity to, in fact, put images, sounds, words, as it were, on the same level, or at least to make them out of the same matter, the same material. And in a way, it gave me the fantasy almost of emptying the contents of one's head into the computer, because one's head is full of images and sounds and words. And when it became possible to manipulate images, which was just becoming possible in 1986, the Mac Plus had just been launched. I mean, this was the cutting-edge computer, and I actually brought one back to London and plugged it in, and it blew up instantly because I'd been given the wrong transformer. So there's a sort of mushroom cloud hanging over my Mac Plus. I was devastated. But, that gives you some idea of where the technology was there then. So it's a little black and white screen and very limited capacities. But the work in the Arnolfini has that technological base and has that, as it were, phenomenological base, which is, in this particular case, my being on a hill near Canterbury, knowing that this is the hill where a film was made back in 1944, A Canterbury Tale by Powell and Pressburger. So thinking of a scene, a short scene from the film, on that hill where the scene was shot, with that lapse of 50 years or more, that film that was shot at a time when the Second World War was still running its course, although it was coming to the end of its course, but still running its course, Britain was at war. and thinking there on that hill in Canterbury in summer, in the same kind of a day on which the film was shot over 50 years ago, that again there's all this rhetoric now about the war on terrorism and will Britain go to war against Iraq, and that whole context, and then thinking back on the whole history of wars and representations of wars. My video is not about that. You know, my videos are about the mix, as it were, the mix of the present moment, of history, of the trace of history in that present moment through often very indirect means. So, for example, in the environment, thinking of those sorts of things, we have these poppies, and of course the direct reference to the Poppy Day. There's the fragment of soundtrack where class is very clearly inscribed, thus standing in an environment, a landscape, where as you look out, you're conscious of the extent to which it's privately owned, and there's a whole history of ownership of the land and struggle over that ownership of the land. You mentioned prior to our starting recording what, you know, Bat calls the grain of the voice, the actual texture of the voices of these actors from 50 years ago who sound like actors, you know, no longer sound. There's also the texture of the land, the texture of the landscape, which I think is made up so much of our investment in it, of everything that we know about it already. It's a British landscape, and if we listen to Britain, if we listen to the texture of the voice, we listen to the texture of the landscape, and at the entrance to the installation I've inscribed two lines from Shakespeare, A Midsummer Night's Dream, where it's actually Bottom who's speaking, and I forget the exact citation now, but it's something like, the eyes of man hath not heard, the ears of man hath not seen. And again, I was interested in this act of listening, which is also an act of looking.
You've written extensively as well, books where you've either commented or revisited people like Roland Barthes. Yeah. You've written a book in different spaces. You've written many books, and your work is very much informed by texts, in terms of texts that we might know, whether it be Jean-Paul Sartre or Freud. Mm. But you, of course, say you don't need a degree in psychoanalysis to, yes, understand the works, because you also want people to go to them intuitively, mm, even if they didn't know, yes, the story of Anna O.
Yes.
You still would be able to read and have a resonance of the work.
That's right.
Can we just talk a little bit about your engagement with the written word, your own engagement, and with politics, mm, as well? Because that's very much part of who you are and, yeah, how you've come to your work.
Yes. I suppose it really began at Yale when I was in the art department there in the 60s, because I found myself in an environment which was very unlike the one I was in at the Royal College of Art, where I'd been previously. The students were expected to defend their work verbally. You know, it wasn't considered enough to grunt and, you know, shuffle and wipe your paint-stained fingers on your jeans and say, "Oh, I don't know, man. It's like a visual thing." You know, and I was quite shocked when I went to Yale, because I actually expected, you know, to say something about the work that could be defended, not in the terms that one, I think, rather unfortunately tends to get in many British art schools now, where somehow, you know, theory, God knows, has entered the art school, you know, wall to wall. And you hear justifications couched in technical terms with a lot of names of grand thinkers bandied around. Now, it wasn't that kind of self-justification by reference to an authority. It was rather something that engaged with the work itself. You know, for example, what was the motivation for this shape or for this colour? Where did it come from? How did it relate to the other elements in the picture? How did the making of this picture relate to the context of contemporary art or the history of painting, if you're a painter, or sculpture, if you're a sculptor? So there's a whole historical context brought to bear. There's a whole context of aesthetics. There's a formal language, a formalist language that was invoked that today we might find rather arcane and out of date, but, you know, it was there. Anyway, that's, I think, was where it began. Actually, strictly speaking, it began before that with my getting Iris Murdoch as a tutor while I was at the Royal College of Art. So I was doing courses in philosophy, seminars and tutorials with Iris Murdoch, which again was a sort of intimidating experience for a young painter to be writing the best he could on a text by David Hume that she'd set him, and then having to defend it in front of this ferociously intelligent woman with these gimlet blue eyes that was like drilled right through you. It was the idea of complementary studies at the Royal College of Art, or liberal studies. Nobody really expected you to relate this to your paintings. I was doing that in philosophy for its own sake, as it were. I got interested in it, continued to do it at Yale, because you're expected to do a so-called academic elective. And then, through the engagement with minimalism, with Robert Morris and Annette Michelson, who were writing texts in Art Forum in that period, you know, Robert Morris's Notes on Sculpture, I was very interested in as a series of texts, for example, using actually philosophical ideas to work through a program for visual art, for film, for sculpture. I think, you know, without being self-conscious about it, I think that was a time when my interest in written texts, philosophy at that time, phenomenology specifically, came together with a program for making objects, making artworks, or ultimately getting away from making objects in that sense. So that's where it began, and it came to a head, I think, when I got my first teaching job. I was originally hired to teach life painting, but you know, the work I was doing was, as I say, what would subsequently be called conceptual art. And after a couple of years, I started teaching in Nottingham in 67, and then in 69 it was the When Attitudes Become Form exhibition, and suddenly everybody was aware of so-called conceptual art, and it got into the art schools. I never actually pushed it as a program. I just tried to help the students do what they were interested in doing. But once they started seeing this stuff in the art magazines and going to shows, then that was the sort of stuff they were doing. And I was very much aware of the fact that a kind of approach to art making that was called conceptualism at that time, that had come out of a very intensive and long involvement with history, with certain philosophical ideas, with certain political ideas, because of course the 60s was a very political period, that road to making that sort of work was now bypassed. So the first generation of people producing conceptual art produced it out of those debates and those engagements with ideas. The second generation very quickly were producing out of an engagement with art magazines and with the look of the thing. And that's very much what it is now, of course. It's one stylistic choice amongst others. And at that time, I felt that if I was going to teach them anything, it would be that, to show them the framework that they'd inherited. And I was very much aware of the fact that the whole ethos of the art school seemed to be, well, when you leave, you know, you're going to go into the gallery system, you're going to become a successful artist and so on. But what if you don't? And most of them didn't. What have you learned in 3 years? And I got deeply troubled by this, you know, at a sort of ethical level, about, you know, what was I being paid for? So I tried to set up courses where at least they would learn some history, they would learn some philosophy, you know, related to aesthetic issues and so on. And that's when I first started teaching quote-unquote theory, except you didn't use words like that then. You didn't say theory, meaning, like, everything. You actually had to specify what it was that you were talking about. So that's where it began, and through increasingly an engagement with politics and a questioning of the political framing of art and the art world, the politics of the art world, but also the relation of the art world to politics, to broader politics. And then, you know, the politics of the image, and of course the whole impact of feminism, which was very great, you know, enormous in that period, and having to rethink a great deal of one's politics and what you meant by politics, which suddenly became quite different, influenced very much by Althusser and the idea of, the specificity, not Greenberg any longer, but Althusser, the specificity of political action. So there's, as a feminist pointed out, there's a politics of the kitchen, a politics of the bedroom. Althusser was pointing out there's a politics at absolutely every area of life. So there's the politics of the art schools, the politics of teaching, and I became convinced that the political specificity of my own work was primarily as a teacher and less as an artist. That the idea that you could make works of art that would make considerable and significant contributions to the broader political process, I found that for the most part implausible, to say the least. Which is not to say that art cannot have that function, but it depends very much on the particular conjuncture, and I think it'd have to be in a very, very specific conjuncture. I mean, one can cite instances of works, I suppose, Solzhenitsyn's Archipelago work, the work on the Gulag had a very strong impact in history. You can locate occasionally the works, mainly of writers, that have had a significant political impact. But from where I was standing at this particular moment in this particular culture, it didn't seem to me that works of visual art had a chance in hell of making any particular kind of significant change in the political process. But the educational system, I think, has very important function within the broader political process, and therefore the struggle, if you like, over what gets taught, what you're able to talk about, what you're able to talk about in a seminar, what is permissible, as these became important political issues. So the idea that if I'm going to engage with politics, that I think, in a sense, I felt it was, my responsibility as a citizen. Sounds a bit heavy, but I'm not urging it on everyone. I'm simply saying that that's how I felt it. Perhaps it was because I came out of the working class. I found myself now in a relatively easy situation compared to the people I could remember from my childhood who were very poor and working under very difficult conditions. I did feel some sense of responsibility, that one had to bear witness, as it were, to inequality, to inequitable and oppressive power relations, that somehow should not be lost sight of. And teaching and writing became the means through which that responsibility was discharged, as it were.
And the first one is called Just Say No to Family Values. On a day when you're walking down the street and you see a hearse with a coffin followed by a flower car and limos, you know the day is auspicious. Your plans are going to be successful. But on a day when you see a bride and groom and wedding party, watch out! Be careful. It might be a bad sign. Just say no to family values and don't quit your day job. Drugs are sacred substances, and some drugs are very sacred substances. Please praise them for somewhat liberating the mind. Tobacco is a sacred substance to some, and even though you stopped smoking, show a little respect. Alcohol is totally great. Let us celebrate the glorious qualities of booze, and I had a good time being with you. Just do it. Just do it. Just don't not do it. Just do it. Christian fundamentalists and fundamentalists in general are viruses, and they're killing us, multiplying and mutating, and they're destroying us. Now, you know, you gotta give strong medicine to combat a virus. Who's buying? Good acid, I'm flying, slipping and sliding, slurping and slamming. I'm sinking, dipping and dripping and squirting inside you. Never fast forward a cum shot. milk, milk, lemonade, round the corner where the chocolate's made. Do anything you want, whatever you want, for as long as you want, any time, any place, when it's possible, and try to be safe. In a situation where you must abandon yourself beyond all concepts, just say no to family values. We don't gotta say no to family values. We never think about them. Just do it. Just make love and compassion. Thank you. And this next piece is an excerpt from the a very long, an excerpt from a really long piece that's called The Death of William Burroughs. William died on August 2nd, 1997, Saturday at 6:30 in the afternoon from complications from a massive heart attack he had had the day before. He was 83 years old. I was with William Burroughs when he died, and it was one of the best times I ever had with him. Doing Tibetan Nyingma Buddhist meditation practices, I absorbed his consciousness into my heart. It seemed like a bright white light, blinding but muted. I was the vehicle, his consciousness passing through me. A gentle shooting star came in my heart and up the central channel and out the top of my head to a pure field of great clarity and bliss. It was very powerful. William Burroughs resting in great equanimity and the vast open expanse of primordial wisdom mind. I was staying in William's house and doing my meditation practices for him, trying to maintain the good conditions and dissolve any obstacles that might be arising for him at that very moment in the bardo. I had confidence that William had a high degree of realization, but he was not a totally enlightened being. Lazy, alcoholic, junkie William. Now I had to do it for him. And this is a long piece. I'm going to skip to another part that's called What Went Into William Burroughs' Coffin with His Dead Body. On Tuesday morning, August 7th, 1997, James Grauerholz and Ira Silverberg came to William's house to pick out the clothes for the funeral director to put on William's dead body. The clothes were in a closet in my room, and we picked out the things that would go into William's coffin and grave, accompanying him on his journey in the underworld. His favorite gun, a .38 snub-nosed special, fully loaded with 5 shots. William called it the Snubby. The gun was my idea. This is very important. William always said you can never be too well armed in any situation. Of his more than 80 world-class guns, he often wore it on his belt during the day and slept with it on his right side under the bed sheet, fully loaded, for 15 years. His favorite cane, a sword cane made of hickory with a light rosewood finish. Sport jacket, black with a dark green tint. We rummaged through his closet, and it was the best of his shabby clothes and smelling sweet odor. Blue jeans, the least worn ones, were the only ones clean. Jockey underwear and socks. A red bandana, he always kept one in his back pocket. Black shoes, the ones he wore when he performed. I thought the old brown ones that he wore every day, but James Grauerholz insisted. There's an old CIA slang that says getting a new assignment is getting new shoes. A white shirt we bought it in a men's shop in Beverly Hills in 1981 on the Red Night Tour. It was his best shirt. All the others were a big racket. Necktie, blue, hand-painted by William. Moroccan vest, green velvet with a gold brocade trim, given him by Brian Geisen 25 years before. A rosette in his lapel buttonhole of the French government's Commandeur d'Art et Lettres, and the rosette of the American Academy of Arts and Letters, honors which William very much appreciated. A gold coin in his pants pocket, a gold 19th century Indian head $5 piece, symbolizing all wealth. He would have enough money to buy his way in the underworld. His eyeglasses in his outside jacket pocket. A ballpoint pen. He was a writer and sometimes wrote longhand. A joint of really good grass. Heroin. Just before the funeral, Grant Hart put a small white paper packet into William's pocket. Nobody's gonna bust him, said Grant. William, bejeweled with all his adornments, was traveling in the underworld. I Kissed Him, an early LP album of us together, 1975, was called Biting Off the Tongue of a Corpse. I kissed him on the lips, but I didn't do it. And I should have. Demons in the Details, and it's dedicated to William Burroughs, Brian Geisen, Allen Ginsberg, and a number of others. Once upon a time, these friends loved each other very much, and they made a vow to stay together until they all attained enlightenment. And lifetime after lifetime, and endless rebirths and doing practice, they all realized the absolute, empty, true nature of mind. And they were so happy and overjoyed, they started dancing and dancing and danced and danced. They were so happy in the shocked recognition of emptiness and compassion. They kept on dancing and dancing and dancing, and they danced away all their flesh and skin until there was nothing left but their bones. Dancing skeletons, smooth skulls and speeding fingers, wide-eyed holes and smiling teeth, spinning and sparkling spinal cords, shouting ribs and singing jaws, squirming pelvises, shivering bones, and shaking bones. I want to jump into your heart. I'm gonna come in your heart from here. When it gets too hot for comfort and you can't get ice cream cones, it ain't no sin to take off your skin and dance around in your bones. It ain't no sin to take off your skin and dance around in your bones. You generated enough compassion to fill the world, and now, resting in great equanimity, you have accomplished the great clarity and great bliss and vast open expanse of primordial wisdom mind. But our friends were not totally, not completely enlightened beings. And sometimes 100,000 years in one of the fabulous God worlds or highest heavens is 1 year or a couple of years here in ours. So much for that. Now, at this very moment, each of their consciousnesses are terrorized. They have cut off your head and are shitting down your throat. The worst is at this moment happening. The very worst is happening now. Life goes on. Thank you.
Fatemite Medina in the local pub to talk about the show you've curated. You've just given a talk about it, but I wanted to talk a little bit more informally, perhaps, and specifically about your choice of artists. I was thrilled to see, as you walked in, that you have this interactive space where people can make the boxers' boots. Can you tell me a little bit about some of the curatorial decisions of the placing of the work, and also why you chose certain artists?
Mm-hmm. I mean, on one level, I was hoping to work with pieces that would, or projects that would embody the whole structure of these people's forms of practices. And also I had like decided from the early beginning that I wanted to achieve, but those are like minor things, two things. On one hand, that all the works need to be what I was thinking at that time, they need to be voracious in the sense that they would actually absorb everything around and at the same time have a tremendous sense of energy, that they would need to be explosions and expansive, all of them. And at the same time, I wanted, once I remember the South London Gallery, one of my most favorite spaces in terms of exhibition space, I wanted something that would be able to get all together, not to have any kind of sense of division, and also to metaphorically, but that's something that I wouldn't online that much, have a sense of a megalopolis situation itself, in the sense that you would have a clash of completely different situations and structures that have a stylistic and social different behavior that would oblige you to sort them out and somehow to deal with an experience that, instead of being administered and planned, would need to be about being coerced into completely different attitudes, usages, behaviors, and thoughts. So that kind of overload depended on to a certain point on a very basic principle, where some of the works are enormously big in size, others are immensely small. Some of them are actually trying to drag you in a different space. Carlos Amorales' Flames Maquiladora, of course, is a workshop of sorts. Pedro Reyes' Psychoforum is a penetrable exhibition space with a geometrical pattern that has a size of its own, and the museum had to be a proper museum installation. The Salinas Museum had to look really and work really as an ethnographical museum with vitrines that would be based on very basic taxonomic principles, masks with masks, lead figures with lead figures, publications and folk art and t-shirts, for instance. And however, I was very much interested in having something like a cornerstone or a work that would be like trying to bridge all those structures, because those three structures are fixed, and that would be basically the role of Melanie Smith, who had the task very much from the beginning of using her work that involves this interaction between photographic based or video based images, pseudo abstract paintings and pseudo installations, to somehow finish the task of adding that element of continuity, to add up the sense of a sense of a passage, and also a sense of a moment of ornamentation. On top of that, Francis Alice's rehearsal very much occupied
the
hall.
Of the sound as you come in the rehearsal in the men's toilet.
Exactly. Very much occupies the whole of the show. Santiago Sirius's work, that was a massive action that happened before the show, had to be just indicated by a text, so it should occupy no space. Would be really like a small encounter in the midst of these gigantic masses. And finally, there was a very, very, very specific decision that had to do with having Teresa Margolyes' burial piece as a afterthought and a very, 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 very strong change of mood, where people were actually stepping out of the main exhibition space and they had to get into this small white cube room with an isolated work that, because of its contents and story, would not only be completely different in attitude from the rest of the works, it's the only proper artwork in the show, the only one that is properly about an object and your encounter with that object. But the fact that it is a block of cement with a fetus in it would bring an emotional low point. So that in a certain way, I wanted it to be something like a period, but also like going from a circus situation or a megalopolis situation into a fridge, so that people would actually escape from all that stuff and face this moment of there, of formalism, because I think that it is an extremely formalistic piece, but also a kind of ethical questioning. So I guess that is the only moment of privacy in the show.
So you move from noise to stillness as well, so it's punctuated. You're following the sound gradually. The sound of the band rehearsing fades, and you're in this sarcophagus-type space.
Yeah.
And I think that works very well in the way that one moves through the space as well. And I also enjoyed very much, as you say, using Melanie Smith and the whole idea as well, the grid of her work, the concatenation, the grid, the installation of the paintings. And then from that, also then you see the work that's kind of flung over the beam. So again, you're getting this wonderful kind of metaphor of liveliness pulled through the exhibition, your eyes pulled through the exhibition. I think it works very well. And
I think I should quote you, because you put it better than me. So anyway, as for Francis' piece, I'm very much amazed about what you're saying, because it's exactly that. It's a rehearsal piece. It's part of this rehearsal series. A series that he's been cooking for long, long, long time, longer probably than any of the other branches of his work, and that he has just started to release somehow. And the fact that you thought it was a rehearsal from the beginning really pleases me. I really enjoyed the fact that somebody got into the gallery and asked, why is it that somebody is rehearsing next door? And because that was what the piece intends to do, to bring this kind of illusion or mirage of a real thing happening next door, but it also had the function of creating a sense of distance. I mean, you had to listen it from afar, both from the beginning of the corridor at the entrance of the gallery and the end of it next to the entrance to Margolyes' room.